Good morning. I'm David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. And this is a great example of something we're trying to do more of to help bring to town people who have a lot of interesting thoughts about the big monetary and financial stability and fiscal issues of the day, and so we can all learn something together. If you're not on our mailing list, a couple of RAs in the back, give me your business card and we'll be happy to add you. I'm especially pleased to welcome Hyun Shin to Washington, where he came really just to visit his son, and we happen to be an excuse for him to come here. But it's our good fortune. I've had the luck to learn from Hyun Shin several times and to see his presentations. And in a field where you could make the interesting dull and the simple complicated, Hyun Shin is a master of making it interesting and simple on one of the issues that the financial crisis has bequeathed us, which is like, how the hell do we avoid doing this again? Hyun has some slides, which if they're not already posted on our website and on the BIS website, will be. This is on the record. We're going to post the audio of his presentation, but not the conversation afterwards. He's going to speak for 20 minutes or so, and then we'll have plenty of time for conversation. Take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for that very generous introduction. And it's great to see so many old friends. I should just start by saying that this is these are my views and not the BIS's views, although there may be some family resemblance here and there. So it would be good if we could use this. Yes. Is that okay? How are we doing?
Is that better? Okay.
I think it would be good in this small-scale meeting to use this as a way to really compare notes on some of the big financial stability issues. And the things are not as familiar as they might be, and there are great uncertainties. Now, it's true that our view of financial stability or our understanding of crisis propagation is very much influenced by the mechanisms that were involved in the previous crisis. So, and they have to do with mainly the banking sector. So the watchwords are things like credit growth, leverage and maturity mismatch, complexity, and of course, too big to fail. These are still relevant for a number of countries, and if you read our annual report from this year, we have a very long discussion about this. But what I wanted to just point out today is that if we rely too much on the familiar mechanisms, they have now become familiar, although they were unfamiliar when they first erupted. If we rely too much on the familiar mechanisms, we may be missing new vulnerabilities that are building up. And this is especially true because many of the accountability exercises that we have address known past weaknesses, and that makes a lot of sense. So two things I'd like to pursue today, just to put on the table for discussion. The first thing is the changing pattern of financial intermediation. So the theme here is that we're moving very much from the banking sector to the non-bank intermediation. So the protagonists are moving from banks to asset managers and other long investors. And the other theme is liquidity. What can happen out of the blue through market disruptions with very large price moves. Now, if what happens in the financial markets stay in the financial markets, then this is just fireworks on the side. I think the problem is that we have very good evidence that what happens in the financial markets don't just stay there. They actually have an impact on the real economy. And so I think this is why, as economists, we should be worried about this. The second theme is the importance of having a global perspective, because I think it's very easy to focus on the micro mechanisms. And my background is as a microeconomist, and I've done plenty of modeling of these crisis models. But I think, especially now, it's important to take a step back and take a broader global perspective. And here, the U.S. dollar and the role that it plays in the denomination of debt contracts is really very, very important to understand what might happen. So another way of saying it is the U.S. dollar is a global unit of account in debt contracts. And so even if you're not a U.S. resident, you will borrow in dollars. And even if you're not a U.S. resident, you will lend in dollars. And the size of that, the outstanding dollar credit outside the U.S. turns out to be very large, as you'll see. And that's going to be a very important theme. So here's a very schematic way of looking at financial intermediation. So flows are going from right to left because liabilities are on the right-hand side, assets on the left-hand side. Funds can flow either through intermediaries like banks, or they can be directly granted, like through corporate bonds. If you look at the U.S. and look at the corporate sector in the U.S., so here's a chart from the U.S. flow of funds. The light brown is the outstanding amount of bond financing, and the rest are essentially bank finance categories. If we look at the quarterly changes, you can see the pattern better. This is from the early 90s. The dark bands are, as usual, the periods of MBR recessions. And what you see is that with each recession, the banking sector retrenches. So the blue bars point downwards. But then the bond market is a spare tire that comes back to life and provides the credit. So that's true of the early 90s, and then it's true of the 2001 recession, and it's true in spades here in the recent crisis. But what's also interesting is that you will see that the red bars have continued to go up afterwards. And whereas right after the crisis, it was the borrowers throwing themselves at the bond market because the banks weren't lending. It was a demand for credit story which led to these red bars going up. After around 2010, 2011, it's really the lenders who are really throwing themselves at the borrower saying, look, you have to borrow. Here's the money. So it's a more supply of funding driven. We can track that through the spreads changing. If we look at cross-border credit through the banking sector, that story also comes through very clearly. So this is a time series of the cross-border claims of the internationally active banks that we track at the BIS. The blue is the annual growth of lending by the BIS reporting banks to other banks, and the pink is the lending by banks to non-banks. And I've superimposed on this chart the chart for the VIX, which is measured on the left-hand axis. And you see this familiar pattern before the crisis where measured volatility is driven down very low. This leads to increased leverage and increased cross-border flows. And then the crisis erupts, the VIX spikes up, and we have this familiar reflected symmetry, where as the VIX spikes, the banking sector contracts. What's happened, though, is that even as the VIX subsided and touched new all-time lows a few months ago, banking sector activity was still pretty much subdued. And this gives you a sense of the shift in the pattern of financial intermediation. So where was the action? Let me skip a couple of slides and then come back to them. Now, the important thing, so one of the two themes I mentioned was the importance of U.S. dollar-denominated credit outside the U.S. Now, imagine we have the U.S. border here, and we have banks and bond investors, and there are non-bank borrowers outside the U.S., so these could be corporates, they could be energy firms, they could be property developers. Now, when we think about dollar credit, we normally think about these arrows. So U.S. residents are lending in dollars to borrowers outside. And, these are sizable, just over $2 trillion. But what's less known, possibly, is that the credit that's extended by entities that are outside the U.S., but in U.S. dollars, to non-U.S. residents, this is the lion's share. So the total is in excess of $9 trillion. And the portion, and of that, around $7 trillion is U.S. dollar denominated credit to non-U.S. residents that's extended by non-U.S. residents. So neither the borrower nor the lender is a U.S. resident. So in this sense, the U.S. dollar is very much a global currency, and no other currency has this feature. And the euro has some role, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, but no other currency has this kind of role. If you look at the time series, Which is split into the bonds and bank loans. The pink is the outstanding amount of loans the loans to non-banks outside the U.S. The blue, both of those blue areas are the bond financed amounts, and the black line is just charts the relative weight of the banking sector. And you see that before the crisis, the weight that was taken by the banking sector grew very sharply, and then it's been contracting. So the bond market is now taking the much greater share of the intermediation in U.S. dollars. You see it also in the growth rates. The blue line is the growth rate of bond-financed U.S. dollar credit, and it's been in double digits, since the crisis. The banking sector dollar credit also, spikes now and again, and you'll see some charts later that indicates that this is also very, very important. But it's really the blue line, which is the theme. Now, where is it all going? If you classify it in terms of advanced economies and emerging economies, clearly the advanced economies take the biggest share. But if you were to subdivide the advanced economies into the euro area, the UK, and other advanced economies, then the emerging market share is clearly much larger. And you see this it's the purple line on this chart. It's been growing very, very fast. So why has this been happening? Well, let me just go back to the earlier slide then. So here's the chart for the U.S. Treasury yield curve. The blue line is the long rate. The red line is the short rate. And the depth of that blue gives you a sense of how steep the yield curve is. And if you look at what determines that depth of the blue, the term premium, it's been mostly the short rate. So here is a scatter chart where we have the 12-month change in the short rate on the horizontal axis and the term premium on the vertical axis. And the dots pretty much line up on the minus 45-degree line, which means that it's when the short rate falls by one percentage point that the term premium also pretty much, after a year, rises by one percentage point. And you see that, and you see it here. So until recently, it was a short rate that was really driving the term premium. And when the term premium is very high and the yield curve is steep, this is when banking sector intermediation becomes very favorable. So when the short rate is low, you borrow short, and then you lend long, you have a very large net interest margin. This is very favorable for bank financing. What's happened afterwards, of course, is that we've hit the zero low bound, and the term premium is determined pretty much by the long rate. So these are the red dots just hugging the vertical axis. And so the story now is it's now driven by long rates. It's the portfolio investor's choice. And if the long rate becomes lower and lower and they start to search for yield elsewhere, then they're going to be going down the risk curve into riskier corporates, emerging market borrowers, and so on. And there is some evidence in a recent BIS paper by Macaulay, Maguire, and Shushko. This chart is the coefficient of a rolling regression where we ask how much, what determines the issuance of dollar, what determines the issuance of dollar bonds, and the answer turns out, of course, to be the term premium. It's when the term premium is very, very compressed, especially after the crisis, that we have a faster growth in dollar-denominated credit offshore. So what might be some of the economic mechanisms? I think if we think back to what happened before the crisis, I think the situation was very much like this. This is very much a banking sector-driven story. I've called this the first phase of global liquidity. It's a banking-driven phase. And here the typical story would be there is a local corporate who is maybe an exporter, wants to hedge export receivables, and so borrows in dollars in order to hedge that export receivable. And it's the local bank that extends that U.S. dollar credit. But then the local bank receives it from a European global bank, possibly, that's tapping the U.S. money market funds. Now, when you have local currency appreciation, in other words, when the dollar depreciates, the local corporate's balance sheet becomes stronger. And any kind of risk model, any kind of risk credit risk model, this means that credit risk falls. This translates into slack in the lending capacity of the banking sector, because you know, if you're lending to borrowers whose credit is improving, then you have more, then you have slack to lend more. So local banks increase their credit and they draw their funding, wholesale funding, from the global banks. And so it's this combination of the local and global banks that that really drive banking sector capital flows. This is the huge fluctuations we saw in that first chart. And I've done some work exploring some of the theory behind this. But everything that's in this chart, of course, can go into reverse as well. So when the dollar appreciates, then the borrowers become less credit worthy. Then the lenders then retrench, capital flows reverse, and then dollar, and that can be an impetus for the dollar appreciating more. If we look at the long-term level of the dollar, and this goes back all the way to the 70s, you know, there were two episodes when the dollar was very strong. One was the early 80s, and then in the late 90s. And in the periods between, we saw, you know, very, very large bank capital flows based lending booms to emerging markets. And with each spike in the dollar, you know, we had the Latin American crisis in the 80s, and then the Asian crisis in the 90s. And in the period in the middle of period of the last decade, we saw this sustained period of dollar depreciation, which meant that this was very much fuel to the story of banking sector expansion that I've just sketched. And the big question for us, and I'd be very interested in your views on this, is are we now on the cusp of another rally of the dollar, and what will the impact of that be, especially given the amount of dollar-denominated credit that's out there? Let me see if I should go through all of this. Let me just skip a few slides, because it's not essential that I go through all of them. Well, maybe I should. There are also several unfamiliar themes that have cropped up in this new phase of global liquidity. The one is that many of the traditional theoretical, you know, markers that we use in international finance are perhaps no longer so useful. You know, we tend to think of the national income border as the right unit of account. But what we've seen is that for many emerging market corporates, they've been borrowing offshore through their locally incorporated subsidiaries. So from a balance of payment sense, they're actually foreign firms. And yet, as a decision-making unit, clearly we need to understand the unit as a whole. Now, this is not a new theme. If you look at the 1920s, German firms set up subsidiaries, financial subsidiaries in Switzerland and in the Netherlands, precisely to act as funding vehicles and bring the money home. What's been happening is that even as leverage has gone up, the difference between net and gross leverage has also been increasing. In other words, even as firms have been borrowing more, they're also holding more cash. And cash here means deposits or claims on the shadow banking system. And this, I think, you know, gives us pause for thought on what would happen if these corporates became distressed. What would happen to their claims in the local banking sector? Would there be, you know, pressure to withdraw those funds? Another theme is that as the yield curve has flattened, we've seen the maturity of these dollar bonds issued by emerging market corporates also lengthen considerably. So here's a chart where I've projected a three-dimensional chart into two dimensions. The size of the balloon gives you the amount of the gross issuance, and the height of the balloon gives you the average maturity. We see this increase both in the amounts and in the maturities. And for the first 6 months of this year, the average maturity of newly issued bonds was 12 years. So that's really, really quite long if you think about it. And these are emerging market international debt securities by non-bank corporations. Now, in some respects, this is good news, because we know that the rollover risk is mitigated, you know, because, you know, you have to roll over less often, and therefore, you know, this is actually good news. But here's the catch. The catch is that we now have to focus on the investors. What will the investors do? Now, even as the rollover risk for borrowers is mitigated, for the investors, these long-term bonds are much more sensitive to yield changes. So in the jargon, the duration risk goes up. And if they and if there's something in what they do that amplifies these price moves, then this is actually going to be a cause for concern. And here is the redemption profile based on the international debt securities. This is from our international debt securities data. Based on the amounts of international debt securities issued to date, and by year, we can do it on the left-hand side on nationality basis, which is including the offshore subsidiaries, and the residence basis, which is just on the balance of payments measure. It's mostly in U.S. dollars, and it reaches a peak of around $120 billion in 2018. If we just look at the short term, and here is the monthly redemption profile, this is a chart that just breaks it out in terms of sectors. It's the usual, sectors that we talk about. It's the oil sector, it's the property sector, and it's not as even as one might think. And every month there is a steady flow of redemptions that have to be met. So these have to be rolled over. Now, the question is, if something happens in the markets and we have these very non-linear disruptions and market shuts down, then paradoxically, it could be that the longer the maturity, the more sensitive are these instruments to these market market events, which means that the market might actually shut down for a while. And if it does shut down, then even though not everyone has to roll over every period, someone has to roll over, and that would be potentially a worry. So this is an empirical question. We don't know which is more important. Is it the rollover problem or the duration risk problem? But it does focus attention on the investors. And let me just finish with investors. I think this is possibly where we know least what the mechanisms are. We know from last year that when there is a market disruption, that price moves can be very sharp. So here is on the left-hand side, a chart of the average yields of five-year sovereign, local currency sovereign bonds of nine emerging market countries. And the vertical line is May of last year, where you see this very sharp increase in local currency yields. Middle panel is the volatility of the yields, and the final panel is exchange rate. And it wasn't that there was a huge shift in the fundamentals of these countries, but rather it was very much an investor-driven event. This really does focus attention on the investors. Let me come back to this other chart. It's really this leverage-like behavior that I think deserves greater attention from us. We know that long investors don't have formal leverage in the way that banks do. Many of them are not leveraged, or if they do have leverage, it's very, very small. But it's really what they do. It's the behavior of the investors that makes a huge difference in terms of the market integrity. And if there are forces at work that mean that investors act so as to amplify the shocks, then we may have leverage-like behavior even without leverage. Let me give you one example. This is the penultimate chart. This is some data from Bloomberg showing you the change in the asset manager's derivatives positions. And in this case, this is the euro-dollar contract. This is weekly data. And those two downward-pointing bars are the first 2 weeks of October when we had the disruption. And we had that event on October 15th when the Treasury yield spiked low. Why would we observe this? I think one way to think about this is there are certain institutional industrial organization features in the asset management industry which may encourage asset managers to actually take risks and then to withdraw from those risks when the shock arrives. One insight into this is a result actually from Gabriela La Spada. He's a Princeton student who's on the job market this year. What he finds is that the ranking of asset manager returns is more important than simply the raw return, and in terms of asset gathering ability. And because the payoffs of asset managers, the incentives, are very much geared towards rising in the rankings, so even a few basis points may be enough to raise you from third rank to second rank, and then from second rank to first rank. So it encourages risk taking at the margin, which may then be reversed. So the argument has always been long investors taking risks is fine because they can bear the losses. And if they take risks and then they bear the losses, then I think that would be fine. The question is, what if they then recoil from those losses when the shock arrives? And if they've sold options to sell volatility, would they now buy back those options? And I think that's the key behavioral question. I think we have to meet that going forward. And it's really the way that behavior and prices interact. Another way of saying it is, what will happen to market liquidity when a shock arrives? And maybe we can come back to this discussion. I've used the analogy of the Millennium Bridge, for those of you who know this story. Actually, if you read Neil Irwin's book, he has a very good discussion of this at the Jackson Hole meetings, and Don was my other co-discussant of Raghurajan's paper. The story there was, if you know the Millennium Bridge, this was a bridge that was opened in 2001. It was a pedestrian bridge, but they discovered that the bridge was just rocking very, very hard. And it turned out that the bridge was vulnerable to a particular frequency, which was shaking at a particular frequency, which was exactly the frequency at which people walked. The analogy here is, when there was a gust of wind, the bridge moved and everyone adjusted their stance at the same time, which then rocked the bridge. And then once you do that, you're in this feedback loop. And the analogy here in this context is that the pedestrians are like investors, and the bridge is the price system. So when the price moves, investors move. They do stuff. It makes you do stuff. And then they all do it at the same time in the same direction. When that happens, of course, the price moves. And then you're in this feedback loop. And the question is, and we know that this happens we know that this is a very potent mechanism when you have leverage. The question is, how much of this amplification is there, even without leverage? And I think this is the key for us, looking ahead, especially with all the dollar debts that have been accumulated and the positions. And I think, let me conclude with this, which is a loop that I conjectured some time ago, but I think it's a very unfamiliar mechanism. Even if you have long-term investors and you don't have leverage, if the events in the financial markets translate into events in the real economy, then you can get a feedback loop there too. So if you have a steepening of local currency yield curve because investors are selling emerging market debt, for example, this is going to be coupled with currency depreciation. Investment will just stop. Capital expenditure will stop. This is the most sensitive component of GDP, so growth slows down. And depending on how much of the money that's been raised abroad has been put into the domestic banking system, you may see some events in the domestic banking system as a knock-on effect. But then it's this real economy impact which is going to give second thoughts to asset managers. Asset managers are in here, very much, as a growth story. If the growth is no longer there, there really isn't any reason for you to stay, which means that you will sell, and then we're back to step one. And this is a very different mechanism from the mechanisms that we have now become, familiar with the 2008 crisis, which is a leverage story, an insolvency, complexity, opaqueness, those kind of stories. This is a very it's very transparent. It's there's no CDOs and mortgage-backed securities here. This is a very much real economy story interacting with financial markets. So let me just pause there, and then maybe we can go on to the Q&A.
Thank you for that. As I should have mentioned, when all of us try to figure out why people in finance were in one wing of the university and people who were in macro were another, and they seem to have separate restrooms and never talk to each other, you've done a great job of integrating them, and I want to thank you for that. I want to ask you two questions, and then we'll turn it over. So I thought the received wisdom was that the reason that some countries, say Latin America, did better during the crisis was that they allowed their exchange rates to float freely, and that one of the reasons that we had so much trouble in the Asian financial crisis was that countries didn't understand that, and they tried to hold pegs too long. Are you suggesting that freely floating exchange rates may be more of a problem than that conventional wisdom implies?
I wouldn't go that far. I think on balance, floating exchange rates will actually put you in a stronger position to meet any shocks. But on the other hand, I wouldn't go so far as to say that's the panacea. I think there, if we look at some of our simpler textbook models, it pretty much says it's the panacea. You can just let the currency float, provided that you keep your own house in order and just pursue domestic objectives, then the exchange rate will adjust so that that will allow you to do that. I think what we've seen, and this was something that Ellen Ray discussed, I think, very well in her recent Mundell-Fleming lecture at the IMF, what we find is that the exchange rate sometimes can amplify these global liquidity conditions too. And it depends very much on the way that perceived risks, leverage, and capital flows interact with exchange rates. And it's possible, and there is some empirical evidence for this as well, and it's certainly possible that a local currency that appreciates, rather than stemming capital flows, may actually just encourage, put more fuel on the fire. If you look at, for example, the correlation in credit growth and currency appreciation, there's very good evidence that there's a positive correlation. There's a very interesting paper by Maury Obstfeld and Pio Levi Grinchas, where they show that if you look at the data from the 1970s onwards, this combination of real appreciation and credit growth, they happen together, and together they are the most reliable indicators of travel down the road.
That leads me to my second question. The backdrop of this period, the recent period that you describe, is one when there was a lot of quantitative easing in the United States. So what role did QE play in the phenomenon you describe, and to what extent is that phenomenon going to change now that the era of QE, at least on this side of the Atlantic, appears to be ended?
I think that's a great question, and I think this is where I would just go back to this earlier chart where when the yield curve flattens like this with the long rate now being driven down, the investors who hold a portfolio of long-term bonds will then make the rational decision. They will make the trade-off between the treasury yield. It's a safe yield, but it's very low. And here is a riskier security, but it doesn't seem that much riskier, but it's giving you so much more yield, and so you would you would go down the risk curve. And what this will do is, because of the supply of funding, this will encourage greater borrowing as well. If there's a lot of supply, and investment banks will make sure that there are enough, there's enough supply of bonds coming to the market. And so I think we can conjecture that what QE has done is to encourage exactly this shifting down the risk curve. It's a familiar reaching for yield story. And, there has been some element of that, within the U.S. financial markets. But the story, but the message, I think, is that this has been a global phenomenon. So what's happened in the U.S. hasn't just stayed here. It's actually exerted a much bigger effect.
Yeah. Here, why don't you start off since you're here?
All right.
Thank you, Hyung. That's a fantastic presentation. I'm familiar with your story. I'm a huge fan of your line of thinking. But I think, in a way, my reading of this is that you focus primarily on the supply side of credit, of dollar credit. Actually, what's nice in your story, you have the emerging market borrowers as the on the demand side, which completes the story. I think that I like that. Because in a way, you could argue that emerging markets are at a different business cycle juncture as the developed economies. So these corporates, in terms of, because their income expectations are still strong, so they have incentives to dollarize their liabilities. So that completes this loop. This is very nice. But the BIS view that even in the United States, financial stability risks are rising because of the low interest rate. The problem there, I think, is that you don't have a demand component. The demand side is weak. In the real side of the economy, there's very, very weak credit demand. So how do we complete a story of the demand side for the global economy? So I think the vulnerabilities, as you point out, come from the emerging markets. That's really, actually, in a way, is a direct consequence of the dollar low interest rates. But for the advanced economies, how do we see that? Is there a case for even make interest rate normal for from a financial stability point of view? So what's the role of demand in that picture? Question. Thanks.
I think there is scope for actually looking into this in more detail. I think I'm not sure that I fully agree with you that the demand is completely lacking. What we've seen certainly is that there has been this disparity, this disconnect between risk-taking in the real economy and the risk-taking in financial markets. We do see a great deal of borrowing going on, but it's not, we don't see, and of course it's not evenly distributed geographically. And in Europe it's been particularly weak, but we haven't seen this lower cost of capital translate into greater business investment. And I think that's, for us, been one of the big puzzles. You're absolutely right that, there is a difference in the profile across regions. And, Europe is one area where the banking sector is still, retrenching after the crisis. But emerging markets, we have the polar opposite. There, we see both the banks and the bond markets really, having played a very, very, very big role. I suppose we take a long-term view and a global view. I think that as to what should be done right now, I think we tend to take the view that if we're going to do it anyway, and there will be some disruption, let's do it sooner rather than later, when the disruptions will be smaller, and be aware of what the true trade-offs are. I think it's a difference in analogies, if you like. So one analogy is that we have a very heavy supertanker that we just need to push and make sure it has enough momentum before we let go. The other analogy is that we're just piling up more fuel. And then this pile will be set alight, at some stage. I think that difference in perspective probably explains why the BIS has a slightly different position on many of these things than others.
Ian Daly, Wall Street Journal. Wondering if you can. Jose Vinales has a great chart about the ratio of dealer inventories to amount of debt. Can you talk a little bit about that? And does this not present an argument for greater capital controls or limits on high yield debt holdings? And what is the solution in terms of this flood surge potential?
So I think I detected two questions there. One was about the inventory held by dealers, which is a story about why market liquidity is so low and transactions are low, so low. And the second one was about capital controls and so on. I think on the first point about the inventories, it's true that inventories of dealers have come down quite a bit from before the crisis, and it reflects partly the very, very high levels of leverage and inventory holdings before the crisis. I think thinking of that as being the norm is probably a mistake. And on the other hand, even as the dealers have become smaller, of course, the long investor sector has become very, very large too. So that disparity. So it's really, we should think about the scale on both sides. It's the dealers have become smaller, but that's because they have come down from very unusually high levels. But also, the long investor sector has also become much larger, with fixed income investment being that much larger. One argument that the industry often follows in the same breath after having pointed this out is that this means that the Basel capital rules have been too tight and they should be removed. I think that is not the right argument. I think we have to put this into context, and we actually tightened those regulations for good reason, because they were too loose before the crisis. I think we have to shine the spotlight where it belongs, which is what are the potential disruptions in this new sector. On the capital controls, I think the Ellen Ray's Mundell-Fleming lecture, I think, was I think a very good theoretical exposition of this larger point. And her argument is that to the extent that even floating exchange rates will not insulate your monetary policy fully, then you need a second set of policies. You call that macroprudential policies, capital controls, or whatever it is. She's saying that just letting your currency float, just letting your currency appreciate, is not going to be the panacea. And I think this is a position that I think is now becoming more and more mainstream. And the IMF participants here can speak for themselves, but I think even the IMF, in some quarters, I detect a certain amount of sympathy with this view.
Hi, Andy Green from Commissioner Kara Stein's office, and I appreciate if my question not be on the record, but of course your answer can be. I'm curious if you can... You've set out some very interesting, provocative thoughts about how the incentive structures in asset management have potentially this impact. I wonder if you can walk through what would the result of a crisis in the sector look like? What would be the intervention tools that might be deployed? What is it? Is it Fed monetary policy? Is it fiscal policy? Does it depend if we end up in a sort of Japan-like corporate overhang because folks can't roll over their debt and they've defaulted and whatnot? And what do you do in those circumstances? And then what are the possible prevention tools to be deployed? Obviously, the FSOC and various agencies have been looking at asset management and activities and whatnot. The focus generally has been on leverage, liquidity, those types of things. But does it start, does one have to start thinking about how alignment of interests matter, and do the role of, it's interesting, after the 1988 crash of the stock markets, one of the things that were put in place were market maker requirements that folks go one way, also be able to go the other way. If you've got long investors now all going one way, does that suggest, so I don't know, what does that suggest for tools that ought to be deployed to deal with it, both preventatively and during intervention?
So that's a very extensive agenda. We could talk about it all day, and we'll still not exhaust this. So let me try and do this in a very potted way. I think in terms of what could go wrong, it will not be insolvency and too big to fail and public intervention to prop up institutions, as was the case with the banking sector, because these are mostly non-leveraged institutions, they are asset managers, are agents managing their clients' money, and if the clients suffer losses, then that's the clients' losses, and they are long investors, so the potential impact is very much, the story that we went through, which was the fact that what happens in financial markets sometimes spill over into the real economy. We know that when spreads spike, bond yields spread spike, and there's very good work by Simon Gilchrist and Egon Zakrajcik that have looked at this extensively for the U.S. And Jeremy Stein has cited their papers in some of his speeches, where when those yields spike, it doesn't just stay in the financial markets. It actually has a spillover effect into the real economy. So it's not really the things that normally financial regulators worry about, which is, is this firm solvent? Are we going to have to bail them out? So the first round response. It's much more that what happens in financial markets don't stay there. They actually spill over into the real economy. So the mechanisms are different. Now, what can we do about this? I think the I didn't go into this in too much detail, but we can think about the balance sheet of the asset managers. There are things that happen on the liability side, and there are things that happen on the asset side. So on the liability side, it's things like what do the mutual fund holders, when do they redeem their shares? Do we see huge fund outflows if they recoil from risk and there's a huge outflow from a particular fund? Will that fund then be forced to sell and so on? So some people have suggested gates for exit and so on. I think it may be that may be of limited usefulness in the sense that those things are really trying to meet, if you like, bigger economic forces with rules that may not have that much impact. And there's also the question of what would be optimal in steady state, if you like, in a timeless world, and how would we get there from here to there? If we were to put these proposals on the table, what will that do to investor behavior? But it's certainly worth, I think, thinking about these issues very carefully and see how much, what contribution additional rules may make. Some awareness of how these investor flows react to rules may be useful input into the policy making process. On the asset side, this is the issue to do with the relative performance evaluation and the incentive that gives. If you're trying to climb the rankings, it's not really the absolute returns, but it's really where are you relative to the to the pack. It gives you tremendous incentives, and it does raise the fundamental question of why is there this strong relationship between ranking and fund flows. And the way that we could approach this is to think about the agency problems within the industry, because it's a multi-layered agency problem in one respect, because we have the asset managers themselves, but they are answerable to the trustees who have given them the mandate. But then the trustees are themselves accountable to the ultimate beneficiaries, the pension fund beneficiaries. So if I'm a trustee and the actuarial consultant, the consulting actuary says, look, here are the rankings, we recommend that you go with this fund manager. As a trustee, what will I do? If I don't follow that advice, then I may not be fulfilling my duty as a trustee. And then, given that incentive, the fund managers will be fully aware of this, and that may give them the additional incentive to climb up the ranking. So it's the combination and the interaction of these agency problems which may give rise to these observable features. And there, I think we need to understand better. What is the role of the consulting actuaries? What is the role of the pension fund trustees? And how does that interact with the behavior of the fund managers? So this is one area where we have very little, good evidence. And this has traditionally been outside the scope of research of macroeconomists. There has been a literature In business schools, where our finance colleagues have looked at things like what determines relative performance, and how have mutual fund flows reacted to this event or that event, and these forces and that forces. But we haven't really taken those findings and put it into a macro setting where we view the world through the lens of a macro policymaker. And I suppose there is, we do take some comfort in that there is the beginnings of a literature, but we need to do a lot more.
Your charts and your discussion about the global aspects. Behavior that produces. Last question, kind of. Directly into the purview of might are some cooperative macro-prudential IS has gone far enough.
Yes, absolutely. I think the BIS is here to serve precisely that role, to play the catalytic role in international cooperation on monetary policy and financial stability. But you're absolutely right that there are no good tools that will address all these questions, to address all these problems, and no one institution that has the purview over these issues. I think the first step would be to get a sense of the magnitude and the nature of the problem. I think once we agree on the diagnosis, we will be one step closer towards thinking about what can be done. I think it's also an issue of where we are in the cycle. Let's not forget the role of monetary policy in all this as well. I think we can think about various tools to tweak this aspect or that aspect, but the backdrop, of course, is monetary policy itself, and the fact that monetary policy doesn't just stay within your borders; it actually has a much bigger impact. But more generally, I think if we can move to a way of thinking where if we can move to a second best perspective, if you like, so that we're in an imperfect world, and in that respect, those signposts that are very familiar from textbook models, but in a first best world, may not actually get you closer to the first best. So the one of the very important results in economics is the theory of the second best, which says that if you're in an imperfect world and you have more than one imperfection, just simply removing one of those imperfections may not get you closer to the first best, because what it may do is just to amplify the remaining imperfections to actually take you further away. And the use of macroprudential policy, I think, has become very fashionable, and it's now a very big topic. I think there, just thinking of this as a way to, as it were, shift the burden of the actions somewhere else would not be the right response. I think we have to take it as a group, together with monetary policy, and ask to what extent are macroprudential policies substitutes for monetary policy actions, and to what extent are they complements? Because if they're complements, we have to really use them together in concert. And if you think about many of the macroprudential tools people have talked about, and Don Cohen can tell us more about this, That have very, very similar actions to monetary policy. If we think about LTV and DTI rules, they're there to limit credit growth. But monetary policy does exactly that, both through, monetary policy has its impact by reallocating spending across time. You bring spending forward, and credit is the means to do that. You send spending back. And then the risk-taking channel of monetary policy is all about leverage. And so, limiting leverage through capital ratios and leverage ratios, these are macroprudential tools, but we know that monetary policy has very, very similar impact as well. But of course, they're not exactly identical, and that's why we need, we need to think about both of them and the whole package. But it would be a mistake for us to just parcel off macroprudential policy as this thing we do once we've done everything on the monetary policy side. I think it's much better to look at this as a package and ask, well, what effect is monetary policy having, both here and abroad? What effect will macroprudential policy have, both here and abroad? Let's take it as a package.
Hi, Ryan Tracy with the Wall Street Journal. I wonder if you could spend a little bit more time on this idea of the ranking driving the behavior that could create stresses. I mean, how, for instance, would the activities that we saw in the first couple weeks of October perhaps have been different if there wasn't this incentive that you're talking about related to the rank?
I think this is absolutely key, and this is, I suppose, more relevant for the activist, for the actively managed funds, especially in fixed income, where empirically, I think it's pretty well established that relative rankings have a big effect on asset gathering ability. And here's a quote that Gabriele uses in his paper from the Wall Street Journal, actually. So it's your publication. It's quoting a former fund manager, and the quote is, "The real business of money management is not managing money, it's getting money to manage." Because that's where the biggest margin is to increase your payoff. And if relative ranking is key, then of course, you can be very inventive and very prescient and be one step ahead. But the other way of doing it would be to take incremental risks that will spice up your returns. And a classic example of this would be selling volatility through selling options. You sort of sell straddles. You sell both calls and puts. And then if the market doesn't move that much, then you've picked up the premium. Empirically, over a long period of time, we know that there is a risk premium there, so that if you do sell options, you will pick up a few basis points continuously. The question has always been, and this is, by the way, the... let me just take a step back. So the question has always been about what will happen if there's a big shock to the market. Do you then buy it back, or do you just sit there and take the losses? Now, if you just take the losses, then that's exactly the argument you hear about long investors. They're long investors, they have deep pockets, they can afford to take losses. That's what they're there for. But I think what we've found is that when things happen, they actually don't take losses, they actually buy them back. And one, I think, cautionary tale is the hedging of option, short option positions through dynamic trading. And if you read the Neil Irwin's book, that's where we, and this is my, Jackson Hole speech from 2005, where I describe this activity where, the 87 stock market crash was precisely a mechanism whereby the portfolio insurers would sell options and then would hedge those short option positions through dynamic trading. And the way that you do it is, if you have if you're trying to mimic a put option, your payoff has to be increasing when the price falls, so you maintain a short position, and the short position becomes steeper when the price falls. In other words, when the price falls, you sell, and then when the price rises, you buy. So this is very different from the usual stabilizing influence, where when the price falls, you buy; when the price rises, you sell. Here, the incentive is to be a consumer of market liquidity. and sell when the price falls and buy when the price rises. Now, we know that leverage players do that. And the question has always been, do long investors do it? And the hope was that, you know, they would not engage in this leverage-like behavior. But I think the events of October 15, I think, gives us pause for thought, because I think that's an instance where, you know, we have an episode where we have these huge market moves. And it's very much a market dynamic-driven move. So it's really things that are happening in the microstructure of the market that seems to be driving this. And the big policy question is this a preview of things to come? And the worry is that it is, in that the long sector has become very large, and there may be more incentive to pick up these yields, and then when the market turns, we have these very, very, you know, big episodes. So I think for policymakers, this is a big challenge, because whereas with leverage, we can just, you know, measure it. You know, they are regulated institutions often, so you can see their balance sheets, how much, what is your leverage, what is your capital ratio. We can see it and do something about it. With these market, these very, if you like, a potential market or very dormant, less visible potential forces out there, it's much more difficult to monitor. Unless you really look into what they would do. So these are counterfactual questions. And so we only see it happening when it does erupt. And because the second phase of global liquidity, if you like, the second phase has gone on for some time now, these incentives, I think these potential forces for reversal are now very deeply embedded in every segment of the financial markets. And that's the worry.
Your policy conclusion was, A, we should understand it better. Hard to argue with that. B, we need to think about the incentives for asset managers and consulting actuaries. Anything else? Circuit breakers?
I think there is. This goes back to the comment previously about where we are in the cycle. I think the time to worry about how do we design the problems. The problem isn't as big as it is. I think now it's more the question of if something does happen, what should we do as a remedial measure? And central banks, I think, find themselves in a very unfamiliar situation, because normally central banks would lend to banks. But, you know, although the central banks found very inventive ways to extend the central bank's role. But in emerging markets, the debtors are corporates. They're not banks. And even if you're sitting on huge foreign exchange reserves, it's not clear how that will flow into where the distress is. So I think for the concrete policy question, I think the concrete policy question is more, let's think about these long-term design issues in parallel, but the more pressing issue is, what do we need to do to meet any potential disruptions in the markets?
Two questions, Hung. One is, at the foundation of your concern that the emerging market businesses issuing these bonds have a currency mismatch. If they're issuing dollar bonds to produce into dollar export markets, so their future profits depend on dollars, then there's not so much. How much do we know about the mismatch? And the second right. So you cited the 87 stock market crash. I was thinking about the 2000 dot-com crash. All these things had accelerants in them and prices overshooting. Conventional wisdom is people get greedy, they get afraid from time to time, prices overshoot, recover. It's only when you have these accelerants intensifiers with the intermediary system that you get things like you think that these accelerants are much more today than they were 13 or 25 years ago, and therefore this will happen any more markets, the price overshooting, and the real consequences of.
Yeah.
Particularly compared to 2000.
Yeah, certainly. I think, so let me take the second one first, but I will address both questions. It's certainly true that the 2008 crisis was just much more potent in terms of its real economy impact because the banking sector is so important in providing funding to all aspects of to all parts of the economy. And if that's impaired, then we have a huge shock to the real economy. I think and it's true that in past episodes like 1994, when the bond market went through a very tough period, and during the 2000 stock market decline, the impact on the real economy, at least for the U.S., was fairly limited. But if you think about 94, the impact for other parts of the world were actually quite substantial. So if we take a global perspective, I think the real economy impact may be larger. And I think the reason why the impact may be larger is because the outstanding stock of these dollar-denominated instruments is now so much larger. And this relates to your first question, relates to GDP as well, yeah. But this relates to your first question, which is how much currency mismatch is there? What if they have dollar income? For energy firms, we know that there is a very close empirical negative relationship between energy prices, commodity prices, and the dollar. So in those states of the world where the dollar rises, commodity prices fall, and so it's not a good hedge in that respect. Even for exporting companies, one of the reasons why there was a huge surge in dollar-denominated debt in many exporting countries was because many exporters used dollar debt as a hedge for future dollar receivables. So Korean shipbuilders would sell dollars forward with 3-year forward contracts in anticipation of receiving the money from a 3-year contract. Sometimes you would anticipate the contract. You think, well, this contract is almost there, so therefore let me enter into the hedge today. What happens is that when the cycle turns, many of those orders turn out not to be firm orders. And when the currency is appreciating very, very rapidly, there's always an incentive to overhedge, overhedge being a euphemism for speculation as well. And even if your dollar receivables are actually reliable and firm, there is also a maturity mismatch that comes as well. So the dollar assets that you're borrowing against are actually not as liquid and as marketable as the dollar liabilities will be when the time comes. So I think it's that combination. We don't know exactly the extent of currency mismatch. We have some idea because we have the sectors, and in fact we have it firm by firm, so we can take a guess. But because of this negative relationship between commodity prices and the dollar, and because of the anticipatory nature of many of these hedging operations, we will only find out after the event. And if 2008 is anything to go by, there was a lot of overhedging.
Another question?
Forgive me if this is overly simplistic. You're talking about the incentives for asset managers. Implicitly in this, is there not the poor incentive created by central banks? And isn't that retrospectively a criticism of the QE creating the ill incentive for over investment in these bonds, particularly if in the U.S. investment is sitting largely on the sidelines?
I think I've said it a couple of times today. Monetary policy is extremely important as a backdrop to everything I've said. So we can spend too much time on the nitty-gritty of this macroprudential tool or that macroprudential tool. I think the monetary policy backdrop is extremely important, and I think this is the issue that we should not lose sight of. Clearly there are trade-offs If the real economy needs additional stimulus, then you know there will be arguments for using monetary policy measures to certainly cushion the economy in an acute period of crisis. And if you think that borrowers are impaired and so on, there may be also in a case for maintaining accommodative conditions. But we should not lose sight of the trade-offs. And I think that's the point that it's probably uncontroversial, hopefully, that there are trade-offs. I think the arguments really have to do with what are the terms of those trade-offs. At the BIS, we tend to think that it's pretty steep. In other words, the cost of fairly steep. Other central banks may have a different view. But I think it's the terms of the trade-off rather than whether it's there.
Neil? Neil Irwin from the New York Times.
You pay him for those plugs for the book, or are those voluntary?
No, we're supposed to get covers out. So is there an argument that we've had a couple of these feedback loops in the last year, the October volatility, the taper tantrum last year, and markets do what they do, and some people took losses, and if you look at the macro data series, there's no evidence of any real effect from either of those. Might this be the kind of thing that that can happen in a vacuum and not really affect the real economy and not be something we need to sweat about too much?
I mean, that's always a possibility. And I think certainly from a U.S. context, I think that would be a reasonable hypothesis. And with these episodes that we've had with the taper tantrum last year and with the events of this October probably haven't had that much of an impact on the real economy. U.S. economy is very strong. It's the locomotive that seems to be pulling the rest of the world. But what we should not lose sight of the fact is that there is this global perspective too. There's a global dimension. And from a global dimension, I think we are seeing a pretty rapid slowdown in growth. We're seeing it in emerging markets in particular. It's combining with the strength of the dollar. I mean, the dollar is still in the foothills of that chart. But I think we have to ask how far can this go, especially given that if there is an unwinding, that unwinding is going to drag the dollar further up as the entities that are short dollars then buy it back. And if we look at past episodes of financial crises in emerging markets, it's almost never the foreign speculators that are the prime movers. There's always a domestic. There's always a set of domestic players who really are the prime drivers. So they're doing the same things that the foreign speculators do, which is to sell local currency and buy dollars. But the motives are very different. So if you're a hedge fund and you're speculating against the currency, then you would take a short position in the in the domestic currency itself. But if you're a domestic player and you already have very, very large dollar debts, then your buying of dollars is not motivated through greed. It's actually motivated through survival. And that's much more powerful driving force of these episodes. So I think the hypothesis is perfectly reasonable. I think that may well be the case if we look at the U.S. But there is this global dimension, and we are seeing global growth disappoint this year. And I don't think it's a coincidence that's happening.
Dennis Keller from Better Markets. I think it's interesting and thought-provoking to think about these types of things in the asset management industry, and with your beginning statement about how we don't want to be always looking in the rearview mirror. But I think Neil and Don, talking when you think about 87, 94, and 2000, and trying to focus on what are the variables and how material are they going forward, such that one would think the probability of a different outcome, both in the financial markets and in the real economy, and I don't really see that from the data. Now, I haven't had the chance to really reflect on it, but I don't see it, and I think it bears out in Neil's comment. And it makes me think that, although important to think about things and not about different things and not think the past is going to repeat, We're looking for leverage-like behavior in the context of behavior we've known for a long time, as was just commented, and you keep quoting correctly from 1995. So this behavior of managers isn't new, well-known long before 95, long before captured there, right? So that makes me think, well, yeah, we can try and find leverage-like behavior, herd behavior, and how that will be different in the future than it was in the past, although it was known in the past and lived in the past and didn't have the outcome. What we do know, though, is we still live, at least some of us think, in a world of too-big-to-fail institutions. We just saw 11 of 11 of the biggest U.S. institutions fail the living will test. We don't have resolution authority. We don't have, you know, we still have the race to the derivatives liquidation. We still don't even have a quantification of the capital hole created by the crisis in 08, and yet we have ostensibly capital requirements now that are supposed to take care of that problem without actually knowing the size of the problem, including the size of the problem as it was with the backstop of the government, never mind the size of the problem, the capital hole, if the government backstop wasn't there. So, you know, one of the things I see happening is kind of a shift in focus away from what I think people would admit are known systemic risks and problems to potential and theoretical risks and problems. And I had this discussion with Andy Haldane, who said, well, look, we'd be criticized if we weren't thinking about the new and the different and the next time. I agree with that. And yet it seems to me that the premise here is if there is a crisis, then we have to worry about second-order effects in the asset management industry before we've taken care of the first. So I don't really have a question. It's just kind of, it strikes me that although important and thought-provoking and interesting, it seems like we're losing focus a little bit kind of broadly, both in at BIS, kind of global regulators and domestic regulators, in a way that one has to wonder whether or not in doing so the conditions that happened before will get recreated because we're no longer paying attention to them as much as we should.
The regulatory program, I think, has made progress. I think quite good progress. If you think about the work of the FSB and the Basel Committee, I think you know, we've learned from the 2008 crisis. And I think the intermediary sector, the banking sector in particular, it has been the focus of the official sector's efforts, coordinated efforts at strengthening both the capital and the liquidity positions. We should certainly keep an eye out for known risks too, and in a way it's going to be easier going forward because we know them now. But on the other hand, I think we should be imaginative about I think we should keep an open mind about where the next disruption might come from. And here I think we should let the data speak. And what do we see out there? And what could be the potential triggers? And what could be the potential amplification mechanisms? And although we have had the banking sector very much in mind, and we've done a lot, the argument here is not that we should neglect that, but rather that as well as that, we should look further.
Please join me in thanking Hyun for such a clear presentation and such good answers.